Welcome to the 66th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Test Match Special announced that they'll be getting Kevin Peterson in to commentate for the latter stages of the World Cup, welcome to the podcast that would be happy to give KP a few pointers.
Now, I think the first tip that I give him would be that it's important not to disappear off the airwaves for a month. And we apologise for having done so. That's mostly my fault. I've been sort of gadding around the Southern Hemisphere a little bit for work and for play. But anyway, we are now back.
You can't stop gadding around, can you? It's
no, I cannot stop gadding around. It is an addiction. And actually, talking of Kevin Peterson, I've sort of been a little bit annoyed with him of late, because one of the things I quite like about the position that Kevin Peterson, this kind of mercenary position that Kevin Peterson's now in, and I mean that in the sense he's not attached to any particular team. One of the things I like about that is the fact that he's kind of a proper, in the traditional sense, enfant terrible, in the sense that he can sort of criticise the game whilst on the inside of it. It's not as if he's an ex-player who everyone thinks is slightly irrelevant. He's a current player, but he's not attached to any particular team or board. So it was very disappointing when he came out with the comment the other day when he said, and I quote, "All the Muppets who are on 18 grand, 15 grand, either you become better or you go and do something else. The best players will play against each other week in, week out. That's how you become better." And it was just, you know, sometimes KP comes up with some interesting and thought-provoking commentary on the game as it currently is. Other times he just comes up with some really childish and unconstructive things. And I think the important thing is that for him, he's not attached to a particular team or a particular board, but actually I think he does need to show a little bit of responsibility towards the game.
But, you know, it's showing a fascinating divide, isn't it, between the type of cricketer that KP, the Chris Gayles, for example, of this world, who they're not going to get out of bed for, you know, 18, 15 grand for, you know, a couple of weeks action. And we're forgetting that actually a lot of the core domestic leagues in the world, I mean, something like the County Championship, is reliant on a huge group of actually still talented cricketers.
And it's reliant in two senses, one of which they're the international players of the future and all of that kind of thing, but also, you know, the huge grassroots elements of the sport, of people who just play for love in the kind of lower leagues of cricket. That's just their reality, and it's just an extraordinary thing to come out and say, oh, you know, if you're not earning megabucks, then you're basically worthless within the context of the game. But anyway, are you looking forward to hearing...
Well, as Reverse Threat Radio's Australian correspondent, or in fact, Southern Hemisphere correspondent, have you got
official
any...
and exclusive...
I'm looking for inside track here. Have you any inside track on that extraordinarily named T20 league you have out there?
The BBL, the Big Bash League, is awful. I always think it sounds a bit like KFC or something else. But anyway, yeah, I mean, the thing is, as listeners to this podcast will know, I'm not a big fan of 2020 and I'm not a big fan of these kind of razzmatazz competitions. But actually, what I've been quite impressed with the BBL is... sorry, I can't say it without sounding really sarcastic with the BBL, is... the fact that they've managed to create real buzz around it. When it was Brett Lee's last match a couple of weeks ago at the SCG, which is just down the road from me, it was completely sold out. They've got some really interesting sort of current and recently retired players to commentate on games. Like Ponting has turned out to be a really interesting commentator, actually. And then they gave all the TV rights, not to the highest bidder, but to Channel 10, who are a sort of impoverished station out here, who basically have given it top billing simply because they don't have anything else that's, you know, going to compete with this, in the sense they don't have any of the big American TV shows or anything like that. So
to understand for UK listeners, is Channel 10 something that everyone gets?
Yes. Yeah. Everyone gets it. It's free to air, but it's not, but it's sponsored by advertising rather than by, so it's kind of ITV equivalent, effectively. It's not a BBC channel equivalent or channel, actually, no, it is a Channel 4.
Because, you know, this is really interesting in the context that a lot of the counties, when interviewed by Crick Info to basically say, you know, what needs to change for next season, an overwhelming response was, we need T20 on free-to-air. You know, it's very interesting that that's obviously been part of the BBL puzzle.
Oh, no, and it really has, and they've really, really got it out there, and it means that, you know, these evening matches in the weeks are well attended in person and actually get a bit of sort of coverage in coverage on air. And actually, you know, you have bus stops out here have great big BBL posters all over them. I mean, there is a real buzz about it, and actually that's something that I don't much like 2020, but if you're going to do it, at least do it properly. And actually the Big Bash League is they're doing it pretty properly. So anyway, but the exciting thing actually for me this year is the fact that the World Cup's
on
coming
your doorstep.
Up because on my doorstep. I haven't actually booked any tickets yet, which is ridiculous, but I'm desperate to see England Afghanistan is happening at the SCG, and the other great game is South Africa West Indies are playing here at the SCG as well. So anyway, that'll be good. But anyway, what are you, you know, huddling in the cold back in the UK? Tell me about your thoughts on the World Cup.
Well, so I was thinking, what, I mean, the build-up to the World Cup has been very, very muted so far in England. And I think a lot of that is linked to the fact that expectations are incredibly low. I think Owen Morgan's appointment has brought a bit of a buzz to things. There's a sense that at least England are going to have a go. But I don't think anyone really believes there's a prospect of them winning. I mean, I was thinking of the three things that I really want to get out of this World Cup. I would love New Zealand to win the tournament. I think we talked before about they had a fantastic 2014. I just really like their squad. It's very understated, few big name stars, but very well balanced and quite special talents. And I think it would be great for cricket to have a genuinely surprise winner. You know, someone to come out of nowhere to win it. But I think it also would be really important for the game to show that you don't have to be one of the ultimate elite, one of the really, really big sides to win these big tournaments.
And I mean, that's been sort of the story of some of the past World Cups as well, with some of the surprises. I mean, the one that springs to mind for all the wrong reasons is obviously Ireland beating Pakistan in the West Indies. Obviously, they beat England as well, but beating Pakistan in the West Indies afterwards. Bob Woolmer's untimely death came about, but them beating England in the World Cup after that, and that's the other thing that you sort of rub your hands and relish for with these World Cups, actually, isn't it? Is the chance for those smaller nations who otherwise just don't really have a say on the international stage to actually make some kind of a statement.
We desperately need some of those shocks, because unfortunately the World Cup still has retained this rather dismal format where you have close to a month of these group stages full of big teams playing smaller teams, and frankly, unless some of the smaller teams turn them over, it could get very, very dismal. I think the stakes are higher for Ireland now than ever before. I've become increasingly convinced of the fact that they've got a real case for test member status, especially in a world that, you know, Zimbabwe and Bangladesh retain test member status. And I just think another big win, maybe even another couple of big wins, and the ICC are going to find it hard to ignore them. My final sort of real wish for the World Cup is it would be great if it sort of decided the future of 50-over cricket, because I think 50-overs, you know, is it a real crossroads as a format? If the World Cup is a great success and the format goes down very well, then I think we need to work out, right, where does this fit in the landscape? How do we make this meaningful? If, on the other hand, it's really a bit of a disaster and we get a lot of one-sided, dull games, we have that old problem of the tedious middle overs, then frankly, maybe this World Cup will be the moment where we say, actually, we can leave this behind, we'll have Test on one side, we'll have T20 on the other, and this strange little middle ground we'll just abandon. So either way, I think it would be great if this World Cup decided that.
The archives. In this episode, Andy is going to be describing to us cricket's most bizarre international tournament, the Hong Kong Sixes.
I've always had a strange fascination with this tournament. I ended up a long time ago randomly catching some of it on TV and wondering, where have all the fielders gone? This is sort of cricket, but not as you know it. And just this stunning setting, they hold it at the Kowloon Cricket Club, which is this extraordinary cricket club squeezed between Hong Kong's massive high-rise buildings. It's a really dramatic setting. And for a sort of young cricket fan, it was impossible to make any sense of this tournament. The rules, not surprisingly, it's six players a side. All players bar the wicketkeeper must bowl, so very much favours all-rounders. Batsmen retire not out on reaching 31 runs, which is a fairly hilarious rule that basically forces you to attempt a six kind of at the end of your innings. It has attracted, over its time, a really world-class list of players since it was founded in 1992. I mean, I could go on and on, but Lara's been involved, Warne, McGrath, Kumble. So I think it's important to say out from the outside that this in its prime, this was a tournament that actually attracted the very, very best.
Can I just jump in quickly on that, when you're talking about the rules? So is it five overs a side? So each bowls one over, basically, and no one bowls. Everyone bowls one over and only one over. Because it's interesting, I mean, and it's been around for, a good sort of 30 years now?
So it's been around since 92. So it's
92?
Yeah, so I think they've had about 20 versions of the tournament, yeah.
And you just think that in this really was the kind of this is 2020 on steroids, basically. And it's interesting that it's been around for so long, and, you know, it was such a shock when 2020 cricket came around. And in fact, there's been this game that's even more ludicrous that's existed for a while, which people, you know, of that calibre have been involved in.
Well, and also, obviously, so built around batsmen and scoring runs. Because, you know, for a start, you've got four fielders. You know, it's a pretty thankless task being a fielder in this game. You've also
You're there to collect the ball from the boundary, basically.
Quite. And you've also inevitably got the fact that some of the bowling is pretty middling, because even your best bowler only gets to bowl a single over. So it really is a format built entirely around batsmen. And I think it's worth saying, actually, the scorecards are quite extraordinary as a result. So they make T20 look very pedestrian. South Africa won the 2012 tournament with 142 for 2 off their 5 overs. So a run rate of 28.4. Yeah. Not surprisingly, this leads to some fairly entertaining bowling figures. So in that same game, Pakistan's Yasir Shah, who was actually doing very well just a couple of months back in the UAE, went for 39 off his single over. So it really isn't a bowlers tournament. What's interesting is that the international teams did take this quite seriously. So England, who actually, this is the only international tournament around where England can claim to be the most successful side. They won it 6 times, and they gave it a nice balance between, they gave promising young players their first chance of international cricket, and they also used it as a bit of a consolation prize for some county pros who never really made it in the international game. So someone like Dimitri Mascarenhas, who got a few games obviously for England, but actually used to go out quite regularly to Hong Kong. Interestingly, a few countries took things a little bit more seriously. So it was interesting to note that in 2012 and 2011, Umar Akmal, who was at that time right in the middle of the Pakistan Test and ODI team, Pakistan actually did send him out to play, you know, suggesting that they actually still took this sixes stuff relatively seriously.
Because you do have to wonder actually how much, I don't mean how much skill, because obviously there is quite a lot of skill involved, and good batsmen do dominate. But it's such a weird form of the game that you sort of wonder how people sort of prepare for it almost. And it's just an odd. I mean, it is a little bit like just like playing park cricket, basically, isn't it? It's just throw the bat at everything, and the person with the best eye who just happens to connect the best is going to win it for their team.
And I think the park cricket analogy is right, because I think this is sort of maybe the charm behind the sixes, is that you're effectively just watching professional cricketers having a lark, having a bit of fun. There really isn't much seriousness to it. There is obviously a bit of skill, but there's a sense of just throw the bat at everything. It's very low back. And ultimately, the stakes were never that high. I think it's interesting to think about whether we've seen the last of it. And I think the fact that we may have done is quite indicative of the way cricket landscape has shifted. It was cancelled in 2013 and 2014 because basically Hong Kong has this pot of money that it gives out for big events that could get in tourists, and interestingly the government just decided it no longer made sense, the money no longer added up. Crucially as well, the TV money was not there that had been previously, and I think the key thing here is 2020, you know, with so many 2020s, it's very hard to see a place for this in the landscape. The schedule is incredibly crammed as well. But a really interesting point is around the game's finances, because I think it used to be seen as a bit of a money spinner. But actually, the sums of money in the game have changed so dramatically. So in 2012, the winner of the Hong Kong Sixes got $120,000. I mean, we've already talked about this in the podcast earlier, that, you know, for that sum of money, I don't know if you even get Chris Gayle to turn up for an afternoon. You know, and this is, I think it's kind of been left behind. But perhaps the surprise, actually, is that such an odd, silly tournament survived so long.
And I suppose, ironically, actually, in the sort of in the 21st century, and as you say, in a sort of cricket landscape in which the sums of money involved are just so much bigger, ironically, the only way that you can really see it existing is if it's set up in a really, really serious way. And nations started fielding teams of their very best players rather than, you know, of just players who wanted a laugh.
To the review, and this episode we've been reading Fred Truman by Chris Waters. Waters entered journalism in 1995 at Barrow's Worcester Journal before returning home to start his sports writing career on the Lincoln Chronicle. In 1999, he became cricket correspondent at the Nottingham Evening Post, and since 2004 has been cricket correspondent of the Yorkshire Post.
Now, Fred Truman is one of those people who I'm obviously aware of as often being called the greatest fast bowler that ever lived, or certainly the greatest English fast bowler that ever lived, but who one has a lot of different impressions about. One of them is this idea of him smoking a pipe, downing pints of ale. The other one of him is this, the image that was put forward in his own biography of him as a nature-loving young child who grew into this, you know, accidentally successful older man. And one of the wonderful things about this book is the way that it examines those myths, the things that Truman said about himself and the things that other people said about Truman, and then sets them against a really sort of warts and all biography of the man. And certainly I spent much of the book being absolutely fascinated and constantly surprised by the stories and the descriptions in it.
It's amazing how powerful Truman's reputation was. One of the ongoing themes in the book is how he's consistently accused of doing things he didn't do, simply because of his reputation. But the problem is, it's hard to always be sympathetic, because firstly, he loved this reputation. You know, he'd use it, he'd play up to it, he'd manipulate. I mean, the whole pipe smoking sort of Jack the Lad kind of thing, he would use that. And also, where I think Waters is just excellent is he's so balanced and poised throughout. And this really comes to a head in his description of the 1953 tour of the West Indies, where Truman goes on to be the only player from MCC who is fined for his conduct on the tour, despite several other players. And Waters is quite clear that he was unfairly victimized on a lot of occasions, but he also did make some genuine mistakes. You know, the fact his intentional aggression and injuring, actually, of a couple of West Indian players. So Waters is not trying to kind of whitewash Truman's reputation. He's willing to show that there was a bad, but there was also a sense where he was often cursed by this expectation other people had of his behavior.
And actually, quite often with the biographies that we read of complex cricketers, there's a tendency to sort of flatten them out, to sort of simplify their characters somehow. But what actually, and it's something that we were chatting just now before we started recording about, one thing that sprung to both of our minds as we were reading this is the really strong comparisons with Kevin Peterson and with the whole Kevin Peterson in England saga. And I think that the reason for me that comparison came about so readily was because the situation with Truman was just as rich and complex as the situation with Peterson is. And actually, that's one of the great joys of Chris Waters' writing, is that he, you know, he's obviously a very sympathetic writer. He's very sympathetic towards Truman. He talks about the fact that Truman was, you know, one of his heroes. But at the same time, there is a real degree of sort of nuance and a real degree of objectivity in sort of putting forward the facts.
I think the Peterson comparison is spot on in two different ways. I think firstly, Waters' analysis of Truman, that basically he was victimized, but he did make some mistakes, is pretty much true of Peterson as well. I think Peterson has clearly made some mistakes, but we've also clearly got to a stage where we blame almost everything on him. But secondly, I think one of the saddest things about this story is the way Truman's retirement was dominated by bitterness and regret. You know, he ranted about the players of the present day. He talked endlessly about the games he didn't play for England. And really sadly, I think that might become a feature of Peterson. You know, you've already mentioned in this podcast some of the bitterness he shows towards some current players. He's already talking about the games he should be playing for England. So I think there's a very clear comparison there.
Now, another thing that I hadn't quite realised about Truman was, I mean, obviously he has this reputation as the, you know, the pipe smoking, beer swilling, you know, TMS ranter towards the end of his life. But I wasn't actually quite aware of how many varied stories there were about his life. And one of the great joys of this book is the way that Waters stitches together a real sort of chronicle of his life, which includes, you know, the marriage of Truman's daughter to a Hollywood related superstar, and all kinds of things. And you really feel throughout this book as if you're almost reading a novel. Slightly, I felt at times. And that, you know, again, that's one of the great joys of Waters' writing.
He's extremely strong at bringing in the other cast of characters. I mean, I found that this was often a really moving book, and one of the threads that I found very moving was Truman's relationship with his father. And there's a couple of beautiful moments. The first, when Truman is picked for Yorkshire for the first time, and his dad is just waiting out the house to see him. And Truman says his father could never really bring himself. It wasn't the Yorkshire way to sort of say, I'm proud of you. But he said the way he held his Yorkshire cap and just sort of stroked it, you know, quietly contented. A guy who'd worked all his life, you know, to get the best for his children. That moment when he's proud of his son. But there's a moment that I found even more moving than that, actually, when Truman comes back from that 1953 West Indian tour. And the dad says to him, and he's been reading horrible stories about Truman in the papers for months, and his dad says to him, look, you know, Fred, is it true what they've been saying? And Fred Truman looks his dad in the eye and says, look, it's not true, Dad. I was a scapegoat. And the dad says, son, that's good enough for me. And that was it. And, you know, I thought that was a really kind of very touching, very, very powerful moment.
Now, I think you were observing earlier that there's something about Yorkshire cricket writers that just, you know, makes them pretty damn good. Mm. And I think it's fair to say that this is certainly one of the finest cricket books I've ever read. Actually, just as I started reading it, I just finished reading Richard Flanagan's new book, not about cricket at all, which just won the Booker Prize. And I was kind of thinking, oh God, any book that I read after this is really going to sort of suffer in comparison. But this really stood up in terms of the content and the style of the writing.
But
so
I think there are so many bad cricket biographies around, and that you look at the sort of template that Waters uses for this, because in a sense it's not super clever. He uses very much a chronological story, but he just does it so brilliantly. You know, he's spoken to all the right people. He also isn't really, he's balanced throughout. There isn't really an aggressive agenda either way. You know, he's not trying to salvage Truman's reputation totally or bury him.
So in conclusion, I think what we're saying is read it.
To the interview, and this episode I spoke to Tim Wigmore. Tim has written extensively for Crick Info, and he is the co-author of Second 11, Cricket in Its Outposts. The book's out on January 18th and has a foreword from Gideon Hay. Tim also writes on politics for The New Statesman. Hi Tim, thanks very much for coming on Reverse Sweat Radio. I'd like to start by talking about Second 11, Cricket in Its Outposts, the book that you've recently co-written. And I wondered if you could give us a bit of a summary of the book and also an idea of its aims.
Cheers. Yeah, firstly, thanks very much for having me on the show. I guess so that the book is really just to show, you know, the stories that exist in associate cricket. I mean, people think cricket's only about the top eight nations or whatever, but actually, I mean, there's 106 members of the ICC. We only really hear about a few of them. Over a million players play cricket in countries that aren't full members. So we just actually wanted to sort of highlight these stories a bit and explain what's going on, explain what motivates people to play, explain the structure, explain the limits of that everything that these countries are facing, and to just get a sense of cricket in these countries and how it actually works. And I think a big kind of a risk of doing a book like this is you can fall into kind of a thing of doing loads of underdog stories and plucky minnows, blah, blah, blah. We wanted to avoid that. So, I mean, we've got stuff like with Kenya and United States, for example, there's the tales there are not so much what could happen as what hasn't happened and missed opportunities and stuff. So we wanted to kind of provide a rounded portrait and show, you know, how it actually works, because I think so far when it's talked about, it's kind of like, oh my God, these guys play cricket, isn't it amazing? And a kind of patronizing, yeah, it's almost, yeah, like you're,
oh, so
yeah.
What, was there a tipping point for you? Because a lot of cricket fans, I guess I would count myself in this category, I follow associate cricket from a distance and I'll check the scorecards on Crick Info from time to time, and I'm always interested in how associates obviously do in things like the World T20, but was there a sort of tipping point for you where this became more than just a sort of curiosity and actually a serious passion?
I think, yeah, I mean, obviously the World Cup in 03 with Kenya against semi-finals, and then in 07 with Ireland going to the second stage there, those were big points. And it's more sort of after Ireland's success in 07, you kind of, and then they did well in the World's 20 against 2009, and, you know, Ed Joyce, Owen Morgan playing for England. So you kind of think, well, you know, these guys, they're not much worse than, well, certainly they're equal with Zimbabwe, Bangladesh, whatever. So I kind of started asking, what are the obstacles? You know, why aren't they able to play tests and stuff? And getting more and more angry about that. And that, I guess, culminated with, before the World Cup in 2011, it was planned that the World Cup 2015 would be reduced to 10 teams. Mm. And after Ireland, with Kevin O'Brien, you know, famous innings in Bangalore, beat England, it was announced by the ICC that this World Cup that's about to happen would be a 10-team invite-only affair, really a champion's trophy. That was overturned, but that, unfortunately, the World Cup 2019 is still planned to be 10 teams, albeit with a small chance of qualification.
Why do you think the ICC it sort of gets it wrong in this regard? I mean, do you think it's a very conscious attempt to exclude the associates, or is it more just like a narrow-minded desire to protect the big teams? Because you would think that actually it's in everyone's interest to see the game grow. I mean, where do you think these decisions have sort of originated from the ICC?
Well, first, the ICC are really very pro-expansion of cricket. They've done a number of really incredible things. So the problem is the ICC has very little power constitutionally, and that was actually true. Well, I mean, the big three reforms last year have kind of extent of amplified that. That was true before. It's always been a weak organisation, certainly much weaker than FIFA, for example. You know, FIFA constitution, whether you're Mauritius or Brazil, you still really count the same terms of your voting clout. ICC in its current and previous forms has always avoided that. And I guess, so the big three seems to be interested in expansion, and that's, I think there's two reasons for that. Firstly, it's short-term money maximisation, which is not the same at all, as you kind of alluded to, as long-term money maximisation. But the emphasis really is just on maximising revenue in the next 2 or 3, 5 years, whatever. And then there was the significant financial kind of consequences of India and Pakistan falling at the first hurdle in 07, and the India-Pakistan game turned into Ireland v. On we're playing there.
Do you think you need what might, because I think Ireland's the really interesting example to allude to, because it would seem really exciting commercially to have something like Ireland England test matches. Do you think you almost need just one of these associates to break through to maybe change the way some of the top nations are thinking about this at the moment? Because it just seems to me, I mean, I like the distinction you made between short term and long term money maximisation, because actually it seems to me that there's a real trick being missed here. I mean, something like an Ireland-England test series, even if I was looking at it as in a coldly financed point of view rather than as a fan, seems a very good proposition. Is that what we need? Do we just need one associate to break through and that may lead to more? Or
I think you kind of need several, because I think the danger is only one associate that's breaking through. You kind of think, no, that's an endgame in itself and the others are all crap. And that's in terms of, as you said, I mean, Ireland, you know, if Ireland in the World Cup, if they get to the quarterfinals and they're playing at Sydney with a huge Irish expat population, you could have half of Sydney cricket ground wearing Irish green. That would be a huge, huge moment, and actually, from a commercial point of view as well, show that it really could help to increase the kind of revenue for everyone in the long term. I guess the problem is that by having more, the structure of cricket is such that the big three now have so much power, and I think they think that if the game got big in China or America or whatever, that would kind of undermine their power. So it's depressing. I mean, the Olympic Games is one example. IOC are very keen for cricket to join. Rugby Sevens is joining in 2016, the Olympics, and there's already been huge improvements there. I mean, in China, for example, Rugby Sevens is beginning to get quite a bit. So, I mean, the World Cup as well, because the only sport to make its World Cup shorter. So there's all these instances.
I must say, the Olympics is one thing we've talked about on the podcast before that seems like a desperate sort of missed opportunity. I mean, I wonder, sort of considering all these obstacles, do you think there's a model associate nation? Is there a country at the moment? I mean, perhaps it's Ireland. You know, you've already alluded to the fact that Kenya and America are stories where a lot has gone wrong. But is there a country that you look to and think the way they're doing it, the way they're developing their cricket, is the way to go?
I mean, with Ireland, I mean, if you talk to people in the ICC, what they all say is that the administration in Ireland is actually so much better than the vast majority of full members. New Zealand is probably, New Zealand and perhaps Australia, and certain elements are the only kind of countries in which cricket is run on a par with Ireland in such a good way. So Ireland, certainly the way that you know, they've done so much to kind of participation has kind of gone up 4 times since 07, I think. And they've, you know, made a domestic structure with multi-day cricket. So they're actually really keen to play all three forms, not just the T20 50 over route. So that would be the example. But, I mean, Ireland have had 11 one-day internationals against Test teams between the 2011 World Cup and 2015. That's fewer than three a year. So they're being given nothing. And they actually had more, you know, in the previous 40 cycle when they were a worse team, which is deeply, deeply, deeply depressing.
What do you think of some of these ideas that have been trialled before, where instead of giving the associates more games against international standard teams, you give them entry into domestic competitions? Is there any value in that? Or I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because I know Ireland went to the West Indies, didn't they?
Yeah.
And played in their domestic. I mean, is that of any use, or do you see that as just a kind of unhelpful stopgap?
I think more the latter. I mean, the fact that Ireland took the decision in 2009 that they were getting not enough from playing in county cricket to justify it. Because actually, if you have, also sends a very bad message. If you have Ireland losing to a county, and the reason they'd probably lose is because they're, you know, you have 15 Irish players playing with counties. So it's basically an Ireland 18. And, you know, I mean, Ireland want to play international cricket. They want to play other teams.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that they should be allowed to do so. And if you look at the people talk about the schedule, but Zimbabwe and to Bangladesh to a lesser extent have huge gaps in their schedule. They've got lots of time. And I mean, if there's a bit of common sense from England, so we talk about one of the internationals in England seems to have, you know, have no meaning. So what if every summer, instead of having a, you know, tedious bilateral series, you had England, Ireland, and two tourists playing you had one quadrangular series in the summer. That could be a real highlight rather than just having these fairly pointless sort of bilateral and internationals. Or, you know, in Asia, for example, they've been much more forward thinking. They've got an Asia Cup every 2 years. Afghanistan were invited last time. Hopefully we'll be invited 2016 as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. There's a real need to think about. I mean, it solves two problems, actually, because it gets the associates more high-quality cricket, but it also gets away from these end-of-series ODI. You have the Test series, you then have the ODI series, and by that point, everyone's interest really seems to have gone. I wanted to pick on another aspect of developing the associates, which I read a really interesting piece where you talked about a Papua New Guinean writer called Lega Siaka. Papua New Guinean batsman Lega Siaka, who signed for the Big Bash League in Australia. And I wondered, is that a route that you expect to see more and more associate players going down? Or do you see him likely to... is he going to be a rare outrider? Or do you think more and more top domestic T20 teams are actually going to look at the associate nations?
Certainly they should be looking, because you can get... I think there's still, to be honest, there's a very... With county size runs, there's a real kind of... almost a very old school mindset, which I think you have to be a better player from Papua New Guinea or Afghanistan than you do than from Australia to actually get a contract. I mean, there's so many, you know, very substandard Aussies who are making a killing from T20 leagues around the world. So they are missing a trick. I mean, the Dutch team that beat England and had that incredible chase against Holland, is amazing that no county trying to sort of sign them as a T20 specialist. But yeah, no, absolutely. And especially because the amount of cricket that these countries are being pushed to play, lots of it is T20 and 50 over, which means they're actually kind of getting more exposure to T20.
There are a lot more questions, I must say. I'd be keen to ask you on associate cricket, but I'm quite keen to get your views on actually cricket writing. And for Crick Info, you've written both match reports and comment pieces. And I wondered if you're getting to a stage where there's a form that you prefer more, or you're sort of looking to continue doing both, continue working with both forms?
No, it's great fun to write both. And I guess I wouldn't, as you said, I do comp pieces. I'd sort of say I do more kind of, more feature kind of kind of pieces.
Sorry, that's the right, I think that's the right word.
No, I mean, it's all kind of, it's a grey line between what's what. No, I think there's a real... I really enjoy doing both, but I think with associates, actually, in terms of features, there's actually so many interesting stories that haven't really been picked up. So there's some low-hanging fruit, which hopefully I've been able to sort of write about a bit and get people that they're interested in.
And you're interesting as a writer because you very much have these sort of two very separate sort of... strings to your bow, for want of a better phrase, where, you know, you write extensively on politics as well. And I guess I was really curious to know whether, in the way you approach your writing, are these two worlds that you keep very separate and you approach with a different skill set, or do you sort of, do you pick up skills from one that you transfer to the other? Or how separately do you treat the two forms of writing?
I don't actually do that much sort of self-analysis, so I'm trying to think. I guess actually they're more similar than you would think in terms of it's the old thing of trying to find an interesting story. Really, my approach with everything is trying to find something that's interesting that not everyone else is talking about and explain why it's important. People should sort of care about it and, you know, do that sort of research. So I think that their overlap is more, I guess, because my cricket writing is almost, you know, with Papua New Guinea or whatever, it's almost explaining how that all works. Kind of, it's not saying, you know, someone gets that LBW a lot. I don't really approach them differently. I haven't really sort of thought about it. Certainly not consciously, I don't approach them differently.
It's an interesting point you've just made, actually, that I guess writing about associates, it's actually often you're analysing politics. Right? You know, it's sporting politics, it's cricketing politics. So I guess, actually, when you put it like that, I can see the similarities.
I guess a bit of it is that as a writer who is a very, very, very poor player, you know, if I'm writing about Ashcroft getting out LBW all the time, there'll be so many more people who are so much better qualified to do that than me, that nobody really wants to read my take on that. So I've got to find a slightly different perspective.
I guess working out where you can be most effective. I guess finally, I always enjoy asking people when they come on the show what their take on the general health of cricket journalism is, because it seems to me to be a really exciting time that there's so many, you know, Crickinfo has shown a real willingness to invest in quality of content. There's such a diverse range of blogs, podcasts and stuff. And I just wondered what your take on it is, and sort of also your thoughts for the kind of future of cricket journalism as well.
No, I think it's really, really exciting. I think, you know, with online and stuff, you know, if you want to read a brilliant Pakistani writer or Indian writer, you can do that so easy nowadays that, you know, even a decade ago was very, very hard to do. So that's been a huge, there's been a kind of, to get a genuinely global perspective is so much easier nowadays. And there's been a long form cricket writing seems to have made a comeback, which is great. The Cricket Monthly is brilliant. Night Watchman as well. So there seems to be there does seem to be a market for it, which is perhaps more than people realize.
Can I ask you about the Night Watchman? Because we're fascinated by the Night Watchman on the show. And I guess, are you surprised by the fact that it's worked so well and there's been such a strong audience? Because in a way, it seems to go contrary to a lot of the way journalism is moving, because, you know, it's sort of the opposite of short form, quick reactive stuff. Or are you surprised by the Night Watchman's success, or could you have seen that?
I'm very heartened by it. It's great. Yeah. I mean, I think there's almost in anything in life, you get a trend and then you get a bit of a counter trend to that. And actually, there's so much 24/7 news that sometimes that there is actually a surprising and a hard number of people who want to take a step back and kind of take a longer perspective. So actually, I think that will continue, because in a way that the need for Night Watch and the Cricket Monthly, as news kind of is everywhere even more, the need for them becomes greater, because people, it's so hard to get perspective and you're told everything's the biggest match ever and the most important thing ever, and actually to take a step back has never been more important.
To the debate. Now, recently, David Richardson, the ICC chief executive, conceded that modern bats have, quote, shifted the balance in favour of batsmen, whilst last July, the MCC's World Cricket Committee voted not to change the regulations about bat size. And this episode, we ask whether it's time to regulate the size of bats.
This whole debate, I think, has been prompted by the advent of a certain type of T20 batsman using these increasingly huge bats. The players I think about on this really are Chris Gayle, David Warner, who wield these quite huge bats. And I think what's causing distress is the fact that a miss hit with these bats can sail happily to six. And I think that's something that, as a cricket fan, is just a bit distressing, because it feels like if you as a bowler force the batsman into a false shot, into a mistimed shot, you deserve something. You at least maybe deserve the prospect of a wicket. When a mistimed shot sails beautifully over long on six.
Yes, I mean, the logical conclusion, well, I don't know whether it's logical or not, but if we take this, if we extend this into several steps down the line, you kind of get to the stage where it's a kind of, if you get anything on it, it goes four kind of situation, don't you? And that is something, so, you know, it's something that when we play at our rather amateurish level, and I speak for both of us when I say that, and, you know, you occasionally get that bloke who comes out and he has a massive bat and he just tonks everything all over the place, and everything that comes off the bat goes for four, and just kind of think, well, you know, is this actually really a very good game anymore? And yeah. I was actually very interested. We were just... I hadn't actually realised that there is currently no regulation whatsoever about the weight of a bat. So what is regulated is its height, which is 38 inches, and its width, which is 4.5 inches. Mm. But actually, its depth, it can go back as far as you want it to, and, you know, the edges can be as big as you want them to. And it does seem extraordinary that there is absolutely no regulation about.
So in fact, the only restriction is the physical one, isn't it? You know, how big a bat can you carry? And I think this represents a trend, and this, I guess, is just really a personal preference. I'm increasingly distressed by the role that sort of huge amounts of gym work play in cricket. You know, it slightly disappoints me that we're going down the track that cricketers are expected to be, you know, big, muscly men in the same way that rugby players are.
That is the most 19th century I've ever heard you be, I think.
Well, I just think it's always been one of the charm of cricket that actually, you know, you look back at the and they're often quite, you know...
You like your David Gowers rather than your David Warners.
Quite that. I could not have put it better myself. I've definitely got a preference for the players that rely on skill rather than heft. I guess the other side of this argument, though, and very interestingly, this was put by Brett Lee rather than a batsman, is he was saying, well, actually, there's a skill in being able to wield a bat that size. There's a skill.
That's heavy, yeah.
I'm unsure to what extent I agree with that. But then, you know, what I guess you can't dispute is that people love watching Chris Gayle. People love watching David Warner. You know, I guess the people who hate it are the bowlers. But...
Yeah, no, exactly. But the other question is actually how evident are these bats? Because there are a few prominent players, obviously, who play with them. But I wonder how sort of widespread the problem, if we're going to call it a problem, is.
Yeah.
Because I think back to, you know, the whole thing about mongoose, which I presume is the plural of a mongoose. And there was this whole thing, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to change the way the game's played. And, you know, you can hit the ball for, you know, gazillions of miles with it. And it's almost like playing golf.
Mm.
And I don't think...
It never took off, did it? Yeah.
You know, no, I'm just trying to think of the last time I saw a player in a sort of serious professional competitive match using a mongoose. I mean, mostly it's because it's got such a ridiculous name. But I do wonder how kind of widespread the problem realistically is, and whether as much as anything it's a bit of a sort of perception problem.
Yeah.
Because actually, as Brett Lee alluded to, you do actually have to be quite strong to, you know, to actually get any force out of these bats. And you look at someone who times the ball absolutely beautifully. I remember Sachin Tendulkar playing a back foot drive for six, where it was just all timing.
Yeah.
And actually, you wonder whether the balance between the players who are big and muscly and need a big bat and the players who can just time it really well with a normal size bat will sort of continue.
Yeah, I think you would certainly hope it would. I mean, one thing that slightly worries me is with the ICC view on this is they've said a key point at the World Cup will be they will make sure boundary ropes are to be pulled back as far as possible. And I can see that being sensible to some extent. You know, there's been the opposite problem of that, where in some ODIs, to make it more entertaining, they've brought the ropes in to create more fours and sixes. But I do slightly wonder if it's a slightly odd precedent to set, because are we going to get to a stage where, you know, every few years we return to this and the ropes get slightly longer, slightly longer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't necessarily feel like a long-term solution.
Yeah. No, it does. It certainly seems odd, I have to say, as I said, that there is no law at all about weight, that there is no limit at all about weight, but there is a limit about length and width.
Yeah, and I think your point is a very valid one. I think you could probably look at the balance at the moment between the big bat wielders and the sort of the more skillful, the Jayawardene-esque players, where and you'd probably say at the moment that balance probably isn't out of control.
So there we go. That was the 66th episode. Gosh, 66 episodes of Reverse Web Radio. We roved over quite a lot of material during that. And we hope you enjoyed it and you'll be tempted to come and join us again next time.